Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 272, we are back with one of our traditional Journal Club episodes. I'm joined by Drs. Nicholas Farber, Priya Pakaria, and Yoshio Nakawa to review four recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. First, we discuss a cohort of patients who presented with retinal detachment during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic in spring 2020. Next, we move on to a paper examining racial and socioeconomic disparities in reported visual impairment. Then we discuss an article looking at hormone replacement therapy and its associations with retinal vein occlusion and retinal arterial occlusion. Last, we discuss a study looking at a ranibizumab biosimilar as compared to ranibizumab for the treatment of neovascular age-related macular degeneration. As always, you can find this episode on our website along with the preceding 271 episodes. You can find financial disclosures that are relevant for all the contributors in the episode description. You can also find a link to claim CME credits at the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link and follow the instructions. And if any issues, please feel free to reach out.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with a journal club, and we are joined by three retina specialists from across the country, but we're on the East, all on the East Coast, and my co-fellow Ali Khan would say there's an East Coast bias here, but they happen to be the three people who are available on a Sunday evening who to talk about these articles. So in order, we're really happy to welcome first Dr. Nick Farber from Tallahassee. Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Next, we have Dr. Priya Pakaria from the D.C. area. Priya, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be here again.
And last but not least, Dr. Yoshio Nakawa from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Yoshi, welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to do our traditional journal club format where we discuss four recently published articles in major ophthalmology journals. Again, you can find links to each of the PubMed citations for these articles in the episode description if you'd like to read them later. And the first article we're going to talk about is the titled Clinical Presentation of Rheumatogenous Retinal Detachment During the COVID-19 Pandemic. This is a historical cohort study. First author in this was Love Patel, one of the current second-year fellows at Wills Eye Mid-Atlantic Retina, and senior author is Dr. David Zhu. And Yoshi, you were a co-author in this paper. No better person to tell us a little bit about the methodology of this paper and the results. So tell us a little bit about this study.
Sure thing. So props to Love, who's first author, one of our current fellows, and David Chu. He was a fellow at the time when they conceived of the study, and he's currently one of my partners. And so we looked at the spring of 2020 and compared to the spring of 2019 during a 50-day period, so about 7 weeks during the initial surge of the COVID-19 pandemic or epidemic in the Northeast in March and April. And so we looked at all the patients who presented with retinal detachments. And the demographics between 2019 and 2020 were similar. But to cut to the chase, the main finding was that more patients presented with macula off retinal detachments during the COVID period in 2020 compared to the year before during the same period. It was 50% last year compared to 75% this year. And these patients also presented with worse vision this year during the pandemic. They waited longer to see us, also presented with more PVRs. And the factors that were protective, so patients who tended to present earlier with MAC-on detachments were the younger patients and patients who were established patients in our practice who are more likely to present with MAC-on detachments. And so I think it was a very important study and something that I think many of us have been thinking about since the spring, but this is really the first paper to actually show the data. And with COVID, I think many elective surgeries throughout all medical fields and clinic visits are being delayed, leading to worsening disease burden throughout the body, throughout the country. But RDs are really, it's not elective, it's urgent stuff. And so these aren't elective surgeries. And I think that an urgent condition like retinal detachment being delayed is a huge deal. And in this paper, we don't really show visual outcomes because you would need long-term follow-up for that. But you know from experience in hundreds of other papers that MAC-off status does worse, presenting visual acuity. If it's worse, you do worse. And PVR, you have worse outcomes too. And this is at one center. Granted, we fixed a lot of RDs. This is happening throughout the country, I think, and people are losing vision. And so I think that now is really the time for public service announcements about what are urgent symptoms where patients should come in to see us. And so I urge the Academy, ASRS, and other societies to work on this.
Great summary, Yoshi. And again, we always like to talk about limitations because it's a kind of a research approach to these papers. And I think one of the biggest limitations someone would say if they heard about the study is like, well, this is just a single practice. How is this representative at all? But I would argue, and I guess you would agree, this is a large referral practice. So yes, there is limitations in terms of maybe there's geographic variabilities. But you can argue that the dates selected for this were specifically during the time where there was sort of a national and local shutdown in the Philadelphia region. But this is capturing patients. You know, the practice captures patients from a tri-state area and one of the largest referral groups in the country. So is really valuable from that standpoint. And, you know, Priya, you hear about this study. You're also in a large kind of group that captures from a big area. Does this jive with kind of what you experienced anecdotally? And what does this mean going forward, right? So unfortunately, this pandemic is not over. We're now recording this on December 6th, 2020, and depending on where you live, you know, in California, for example, there are shutdowns that were put into place going to this weekend. There are this huge post-Thanksgiving bump in many areas. I mean, despite maybe some media fatigue about the pandemic, it's a real thing and it's still going. We may get shutdowns as we go through the next couple months as we await a vaccine. What are kind of the big take-home points for us? Yoshi touched on many of the things we need to kind of talk to patients about. But in terms of planning our own practices and what we do, what sort of lessons can we take from this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with Yoshi that we saw the exact same thing anecdotally in our practice in the D.C. area. You know, we also cover a tri-state area in the Maryland, D.C., Virginia area. And during the pandemic, we compared our numbers of detachments and found a drastic decrease and a much higher incidence of PVR. I think it's interesting because I'm starting to see the second round of this now. I'm starting to see patients again who are delaying care because there's a significant increase in COVID cases in the DC area now. And so I'm starting to see that. And I think the biggest thing I can think about, other than what Yoshi said about getting information out there, is also encouraging our referring doctors that if they're closed, and they can't see a patient, just send them to us. Just send them. I never mind seeing patients, and I just say, just go ahead and send them over, because one of the things that this paper kind of showed is demonstrated is that the patients who were established did not have a similar rate of delayed presentation.
Right.
Because perhaps when those patients called with symptoms, the retina specialist said, come on in. That may not be necessarily true for our referring doctors. And so I think one of the things that we also can do a better job about regionally is encouraging our referring doctors to really just send it and not even hesitate. And I think that could definitely help limit, the worst individual outcomes this time around.
Great points. And I think the other thing to you mentioned that part about established patients, but also younger patients, there's many reasons that could be true, but it may be patients that it's always a risk benefit calculation. And for patients now, it was always physicians who were kind of make risk benefit calculations for treatment. But now patients, because they're concerned about exposure, like anyone is right now, they're making risk benefit approaches to, well, do I go into a hospital or ER or do I not? And maybe an established patient knows more of the risks because they've seen a retina provider before. They know some of these things. So maybe when they're weighing risks and benefits, they're more likely to seek care. And maybe younger patients feel the risk for them is not as high as for an older patient, so they're more likely to seek care. This is all just, again, we don't know the reasons, but just kind of speculating on what some of these reasons may be. Nick, you see this study. This is obviously a very large set of RDs for the time period. Talking about 6 weeks, almost 100 cases that were operated on. There are some limitations. They may be missing some cases that didn't show up at all, right? So we don't even capture the patients who didn't even come at all. What does this mean for you? Now, if we have an extension of this pandemic for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, on a local level, and a national level, what sort of things would you want to see?
So I agree with all the above points, and I do anecdotally, we saw the same lag in time of presentation and also more MAC-off detachments. But what this means also is surgical planning is affected. So, you know, we also have patients who can't get their, you know, COVID test in time, or are they getting a rapid test, but now they don't believe in the rapid test because there's more information and almost sometimes, you know, difficult to process information for people who may not understand what all these numbers mean between the reliability of a rapid test versus a PCR test. And so certainly we have patients who are delaying care just because of the fear of the unknown. And even speaking to one of our local emergency rooms, they're seeing less people come in because so many people are assuming that the emergency room is filled with COVID patients and they don't want to expose themselves to that. And so that really drives home the point of, you know, the people who were already established with a retina practice, who knew who to call essentially with these symptoms and had that education, were able to salvage better vision, you know, for the most part. And also when you talk about the limitations and you know, we know, and this is a little bit of a segue, but we know that COVID-19 has disproportionately affected certain minorities, racial groups, socioeconomic status. Well, throughout all of these, between 80 to 85% of the patients were of the white race. And so how many of these people are we not capturing in our data? As you said, how many people are just not presenting, don't know where to present, or they may be even afraid to present?
Yoshi, any final thoughts on this paper? Again, you talked a little bit about what society is and what we can do in terms of education. I think this is a critical issue. And I think that the one thing we have to really get out there, like all of you have kind of said, is there are a spectrum of eye conditions, but this is one of those eye conditions that with modern science technology, you can treat and get good outcomes. But so much is dependent on timing. We all know that. Everyone hopefully listening to the podcast knows that. But that's the sort of thing we have to communicate, that this is different than a macular hole, which has its own sense of urgency. And this is different than an epiretinal membrane. This is different than a cataract. And there's kind of a sliding scale. And just like cardiologists may have kind of a sliding scale of things, if you went to the average American and said, hey, you're having a heart attack, they wouldn't say, well, I'm having a heart attack. I'm not going to go get checks because I'm worried about COVID-19 exposure. Same thing has to be, we've got to kind of kit that same urgency out for people who are having retinal detachment symptoms.
Yeah, I agree. We're used to doing what we normally do, fixing retinas. But I think now is the time to do a little bit more and advocate for our patients, our specialty, and discuss the socioeconomic factors also.
And then my last question for you guys, and Priya and Nick, maybe you guys can touch on this a little bit. I mean, given what we learned, if we do go into a shutdown kind of mode again, where we're only taking care of urgencies, or ASCs have already, and hospitals in some places have already slid away from elective surgery kind of mode, now, again, we have protections, we have, you know, PPE and things. What are your thoughts on kind of the manner of repairing detachment? Should it change in a pandemic, right? So we always have our tools, laser versus a pneumatic versus a buckle versus vitrectomy without a buckle. Do you think that should change your decision-making operating in the setting of pandemic? I know that this was not looked at this paper necessarily, kind of what you would do. Is not really one of the big take-homes of the paper, but would you change anything in terms of your surgical approach? Priya, first?
You know, I really don't think so. I tend to, in general, want to do the surgery that will provide the best chance of single surgery success. And so I don't think that I would, but I did, during the height of the pandemic, have a few patients who were very reluctant. I mean, very reluctant to go to the hospital. And in those patients, you know, I had a lower threshold to do a pneumatic retinopexy, but that's not, was not my decision. You know, we were lucky we still had good OR access. And so I still think that the key should be single surgery success.
Nick?
Well, I think the three areas where you may be more conservative or choose a different option would be if you were going to do a pneumatic versus taking that patient to the OR. So would this cause you to take that pneumatic patient and just have a more honest discussion with them? Can you really follow up appropriately? Can we, you know, be reliant on the fact that you are going to present if things are not going the wrong way so we can go to the OR? The second place would be, would you do a buckle when you normally wouldn't, additive to a vitrectomy? Now, we should all just practice the best care of medicine that we honestly can, but if you would normally in a situation do a straight vitrectomy, you know, is there something in the back of your mind saying to do a buckle now just because of the pandemic? And then I think the third place would be when you're choosing oil versus gas. Are we more likely to use oil just because we are afraid that these patients aren't going to show up? I think we all have the goal of having the best care, whether it's a pandemic or not. And I'm relatively conservative, and I do try to choose those options where are a little bit more fail-safe. But I think those are the three instances where all of us are going to be thinking about those decision points and thinking about them ahead of time and having that conversation with our patients and being open and honest. I think is the best plan to go forward.
Yeah, Nick, I love that point. That's kind of one of the things I was driving at. I found myself sometimes stuck in these decision trees where, again, we're always weighing risk and benefits, the decision to add a buckle and a vitrectomy, the decision to do a pneumatic, but what happens if the pneumatic doesn't work? Can you get to that backup plan? Can you follow up? If you are taking someone to surgery, you don't want to bring them back to the operating room in an emergency condition and use resources, but also potentially bring them in for exposure, the decision to use oil. And so I'll give you an example of a patient who, for those reasons, all things being equal, is between gas or oil, and she was very concerned about returning to the operating room. She had PVR, so decided to use oil, and that seems like a great option. But then there's the socioeconomic intersection, right, where we have patients, many who have lost insurance, who have lost their employment as we head into the new year. And now this patient who I'm working on right now has lost insurance, and now we're trying to find out ways where we can get her covered so she can afford to have her oil removed, for example. So it's really complicated. There's a lot of things that are outside of the physician control, but we're interacting with these real-world issues. Yoshi, I'll give you have the final word before we move on to the next paper. Any thoughts on what we're talking about in terms of decision-making for these patients?
You know, great points by everybody. I think in general, we should continue to provide the good care that we have always been. And I think when we think too much, you kind of get out of your wheelhouse, and you may start encountering things that you may not be used to encountering. And so personally, I think in general, you should continue what you were always doing, think what's best for the patient, but there will be many curveballs this season.
Perfect. Well, let's move on to our next paper. We spent a little bit of time on that one. And so for our next paper, we're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about racial and socioeconomic disparities and visual impairment in the United States. I'm going to give full credit to the two people who spearheaded this project, Dr. Josh Uhr, is one of our fellows here at Bascom Palmer, and Harsh Vardhan Chawla, who's an applicant for ophthalmology this year. And they did this paper, and Nick's going to talk a little bit. It's published in Ophthalmology as a Brief Report. So Nick, tell us a little bit about this paper.
So I thought this was a very revealing study, well done. So what they did was they assessed the 2018 Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. So this assessed how socioeconomic disparities were affecting visual impairment. And this was an annual telephone survey of non-institutionalized adults over the age of 18 in a cross-sectional analysis. And they asked the question as part of the survey, are you blind or do you have difficulty seeing even when wearing glasses? And of the four responses that they were able to give, yes, no, don't know, or not sure, or refused, they eliminated any of the ambiguous ones and took a binary yes or no approach. So the thought is that previous Medicare data sets have underrepresented the whole population, and they collected data on age, sex, race, education level, household income, health insurance status and type, and the time since last dilated exams. Now, the last two were optional questions, so those have been removed from part of the analysis. And they also collected some data on comorbidities, including myocardial infarction, coronary artery disease, stroke, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, and smoking. And of the over 437,000 participants, 423,302 provided a binary vision response. The demographics showed that over 35.5% were over 65, a little more than half were female, 76% were white, 38% about graduated college or technical school. The largest demographic of income was actually 75,000 plus, 92% had health insurance, with Medicare being the most common, and actually 75% had a dilated eye exam within the past year, which actually surprised me a little bit. That was higher than I expected. And so of the analysis, independent factors with a decreased risk of visual impairment were younger age, less than 45, and male. But those factors that were associated with an increased risk of visual impairment were non-white race, lower educational status, the uninsured, and a lower income. And of the 40,000 with insurance, private insurance and employer or union provided insurance was actually seen to have be a little protective against visual impairment. So the limitations, this obviously was a survey study. It depends on responses. It depends on those having a phone. You know, people obviously in the lowest economic or socioeconomic status may not have access to a phone. And we don't really know what the degree of visual impairment is. This is a response basis. And there is a selection bias, but it was a large sample size to try to combat this. And so we saw higher rates of visual impairment in minority race, low educational attainment, lower income, and the uninsured. And this even broke up into the difference between if you did not have employer or union provided insurance, that was another risk factor for visual impairment. And so this probably reinforces some ideas that we already have and some that we just talked about. Those with the lower education about eye symptoms, but also a lower education for understanding maybe material out there, your educational status, as well as your ability to seek care and possibly, you know, the ability of care in your area. Two that really jumped out to me were 13.9% visual impairment in those who didn't graduate high school and 11.8% with income less than $25,000. I mean, both of those are over 1 in 10 describing themselves as visually impaired. And I thought those were pretty striking.
Great, great summary, as usual, Nick. Priya, I'll let you go first. This paper could be timely in any year, but there was a lot of discussion even during the pandemic. We had the movement in terms of the social justice movement and a lot of discussion to kind of the differences even with COVID-19 and the care patients receive. What are your reactions to this paper and the results? Obviously, Nick outlined many of the limitations of this study, but how do you kind of factor this into what we need to do, again, on a micro level in each of our practices and maybe on a macro level as a field?
So I think that the sad part about this is this study doesn't surprise me. There have been multiple studies throughout medicine, especially recently, showing that there is a big disparity in healthcare between lower socioeconomic status and different racial groups. And so, the sad part is, I'm not really surprised. I think that, again, we have to do a better job as a medical community in general of being available to our patients. And one of the things I actually think is key is having more physicians of different backgrounds. Patients really relate to physicians that are of the same background and really emphasizing that and getting more diversity in medicine, really making sure that the patient population and the physician population are similar. I think that can certainly help. And decreasing the barriers of care, decreasing the amount of patients that are uninsured and increasing access to care, whether that's by health clinics or mobile health clinics or just outreach in general.
Right. Yoshi, I mean, one of the big things Nick talked about was when you control for socioeconomic status, and Priya is kind of touching on this issue, there still is a disproportionate burden. Priya talked about getting people in the field from underrepresented minorities may help combat this. I think a big issue, I mean, the other issue is just how things manifest differently in different ethnic groups, and there are certain conditions that present differently. And a classic example that we don't really talk or think about that's been outlined recently is, for example, Plaquenil toxicity and how you should test to that, for example, in a primarily Asian population versus in a Caucasian population is different in terms of recognizing Plaquenil toxicity on visual fields. So this is also a big issue is many of the times the way we learn disease conditions is just a one size fits all. We all know that doesn't work for individual patients, and it probably doesn't work for genetics when we look at different ethnic groups.
I totally agree. And Priya, great point, and Nick also. And I think one thing that as a field we can do is definitely improve our diversity of the physicians who are retina surgeons. And this topic of racial and social economic disparities, it's very complex and it's everywhere, every step and every facet of the healthcare system, whether it's patient-related variables or physician-related. And, in addition to that, racism exists, sexism exists, all these biases will affect outcomes, and the real world is so different from the clinical trial settings where things are not controlled and where some patients may receive more care or better care and some patients the opposite. And, one other thing, if I can mention, that was very revealing to me by reading your paper, Jay, is a little off topic, but these responses were all patient reported. And so, you know, there are limitations in terms of granularity, of course, but and it was just a yes or no answer. But patient reported outcomes, I think, is an increasingly important endpoint, because arguably that's what really matters most. And patients don't care what the OCT's, you know, central macular thickness is or what the autofluorescence pattern is. And they should be able to report, can I see or can I not see? And I thought that was really cool that we brought this to everyone's attention by a paper in ophthalmology. I just thought that was another profound aspect of the paper, in addition to the main topic of racial and social economic disparities.
Great, great points all around. Well, in the interest of time, we're going to move forward and tie into our next paper, which is Association of Retinal Vascular Occlusion with Women Filling a Prescription for Female Hormone Therapy. This was an original investigation published in JAMA Ophthalmology Online, November 12, 2020. And the first author, and this was Delo Song, and the senior author, Brian Vanderbeek. Priya, tell us a little bit about this study and the take-home points.
Yeah, sure. So this basically was a study. Their overall goal was to look and see if female hormone therapy was associated with an increased risk of retinal artery occlusion or retinal vein occlusion. And the way that they did this is that they used an administrative claims database to look retrospectively, comparing women who filled a prescription for female hormone therapy compared to matched control individuals who did not. And they made sure to exclude any patients who had a history of a retinal vein occlusion or retinal artery occlusion, a history of other diseases that could increase their risk for venous thromboembolism, any systemic disease or medication that otherwise affected estrogen levels other than their female hormone therapy, and of course, any patient who hadn't been enrolled in the plan for an extensive period of time. All of the patients also had a prior ophthalmologic examination to confirm that they didn't have a chronic retinal artery occlusion or retinal vein occlusion. And so they looked at the new diagnoses of retinal artery occlusion and retinal vein occlusion in 205,000 women. Their mean age was around 47 years. It was a primarily Caucasian population, 71%, with 7% African-American, 6% Hispanic, 3% Asian, and 3% other. And surprisingly, in the results, they did not find that female hormone therapy increased the risk of retinal artery or retinal vein occlusion. They had 41 cases of artery occlusion and 68 cases of retinal vein occlusion in the patients who took female hormone therapy. By comparison, there were 373 cases of artery occlusion and 617 cases of vein occlusion in the control cohort. So there really was no difference in outcomes for retinal artery occlusion, retinal vein occlusion, or even the combined outcomes between patients who were on female hormone therapy and patients who were not. And so their conclusion was that it does not increase the risk of artery or vein occlusion. And so there's no evidence to support stopping this therapy in an individual who does develop an ocular occlusion. You can continue therapy without worrying that the hormone therapy is worsening their outcome.
Brilliant summary. And again, limitations I'll run through quickly. Obviously, it's a claims-based study, as you said. So they don't know if the patient actually took the medication. You don't have medical records to review to confirm the diagnosis, which is based on coding. And we don't have doses kind of in follow-up to know if there's a dose-dependent risk. It's kind of a binary thing. Either they're taking it or they're not taking it for this sort of study. And we don't know if patients are asymptomatic, if patients who are taking it didn't get diagnosed. Maybe this never were checked. So still, I think this is really fascinating. And one thing I want to touch on, and Yoshi, we'll ask you first. You know, I think this is fascinating because this is an example of how associations can get passed on from generation to generation. And we get study data that says there are some associations that are obviously very strong for, let's say, retinal vein occlusion. A history of hypertension or diabetes or retinal vascular disease, glaucoma as a risk factor can be a risk as well. But there are other associations that get passed on, and I think part of this is sometimes we are hunting for reasons, as we should as physicians. The patient wants to know why something happened. We want to know why something happened. But some of the workup, and I think sometimes there is a kind of a bimodal distribution of retinal vein occlusions. The vast majority occur in patients who are older than 50 or 55 with retinal vascular risk factors or glaucoma. But there is this younger population, especially in younger women, but also we see younger men who develop retinal vein occlusion. And we've seen this, for example, people have written reports of association with COVID-19 and whether that could be a risk. But I think there's also this to highlight, well, if you have a younger patient, you should do a hypercoagulable workup. Are they on oral contraceptives? You start searching for other reasons they have it. And I would argue, and again, many people, I'm not the first one to say this, that a lot of the workup that we do is not necessarily high yield in those cases. And this is another example. This doesn't prove that hormone therapy is not associated with retinal vein occlusion, but actually at least throws some doubt into the idea that this is a pure thing. Oh, if you, and it's an important question for these women. If they are taking oral contraceptives, can they continue it? And this is something they're looking to us to answer. So I don't know what, I guess my point, Yoshi, is that we have to kind of separate strong associations from weaker ones. And sometimes when we're reading our textbooks as residents, fellows, or even young attendings, this delineation isn't always clear.
Yeah, I agree, Jay. This is, I think, a very important study. And it's well designed, it's powerful, it's powered, and it's challenging, as you mentioned, an important assumption that we've been making for many, many years. And these are my favorite kinds of papers, the ones that challenge our assumptions and make us better at providing more accurate information for patients. And but this paper alone doesn't completely dissociate the association, though.
Right, right.
And so next time I see a woman on hormonal therapy, for me personally, I think that if they're young without any other risk factors or reasons to have a retinal vein occlusion, I think I'm probably going to tell them about the theoretical risk, but also mention his paper. And my recommendations are probably not going to be as strong as before, but I'm still going to do the workup because it is relatively lower yield, but then you occasionally do have the patient. And it's a systemic coagulopathy. You can't, miss those things. And so the risk is higher for not recommending the full workup. But if they're older, and that alone is a risk factor for vein occlusions and artery occlusions, I think I would be probably a little more likely to push this paper and okay to continue the hormonal therapy, especially if it's something that's working well for the patient. And older patients on hormonal replacement therapy, you know, a lot of times they really need that medication for their symptoms. And, you know, at the same time, you can't still discount the risks of other thromboembolic events also. Outside of the eye.
Right, right. I mean, Nick, what about you? I mean, what is your counseling going to look like for a young woman with no risk factors and a retinal vein occlusion? What sort of workup do you typically do for these patients? And if someone is on oral contraceptives, they're usually on it for a reason. Are you going to tell them, I mean, they're in their PCP, are going to ask you about stopping it. Yoshi kind of referenced giving them the information and, you know, having the conversation with the patient to make a mutual decision. But what would you recommend if this was, you know, your family member, your sister, your wife? What would you tell them?
I think that's a great question. So, you know, the study showed that it's not a reason to stop hormone therapy in the setting of RVO or RAO. However, a new event can still uncover an underlying issue. You know, they excluded, of course, any other comorbidities or hypercoagulabilities from the study, but we don't know in the patient in front of us if we're looking at if this was a collection of multiple risk factors. Maybe they do have an underlying condition. Maybe this, the hormone therapy did potentiate an occlusion, and this is their first presenting event. I often think about antiphospholipid syndrome and how it usually presents with multiple miscarriages. And, you know, that's just the presenting symptom. Nobody else was looking for that. You know, that's something that presents in 15 to 20% of all cases of DVT and a third of people in new strokes under 50. So that's certainly something I do include in my workup as an aside. The homocysteine has always been an odd one for me because when I've spoken to hematologists or cardiologists about it, they basically say, well, now that we know it's elevated, and I do think that's one of the common findings we find in young people who present with occlusions, with retinal vascular issues, we find this high homocysteine, but then there's not an actionable response, or so I've been told from the hematologist or the cardiologist. Have you all found a similar scenario where you find this value, but there's nothing we can actually do about it? Because one of our local hematologists told me she stopped testing for it because it's information she can't do anything with.
Which is valuable to know because we've always talked about this. If you get a test, you need to know what to do with it. So if you're not going to do anything with it, what is it really adding? And I wonder if somewhere in an alternate universe, there is a hematology podcast where they're talking about those dang ophthalmologists and retina specialists who keep getting these labs and then calling them, asking them what to do with it. Yoshi, I don't know if you've had any experience with this.
Yeah, I recently had two patients the past 2 months with elevated homocysteine levels, relatively young, not super young. And one hematologist recommended, okay, sounds good, adios. The other hematologist recommended starting aspirin.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've seen that aspirin recommendation too. I also feel like I know many hematologists and cardiologists who start aspirin for a lot of things. Viewing again, maybe from a risk benefit standpoint, it's not. I'm assuming a baby aspirin, Yoshi, not a full dose.
Baby aspirin, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a baby aspirin is the ophthalmology equivalent of, or, I mean, the hematology cardiology equivalent sometimes of artificial tears for us. I mean, not to be too, no, but you know, like I think obviously it does a lot more. It is efficacious and it works. And I'm actually not questioning the use of it. I think I had professors in medical school who would talk about they were like, any man over 35, 40 should just start taking a baby aspirin. And I don't know if that's ever been borne out in study. So there's a lot of sort of, and I have no Bayer disclosures either, but I think there's a lot of discussion about aspirin as well. I feel like when all else is equal, they're like, well, it's not going to hurt and maybe it will help. So I wonder if that's where it's coming from.
And Jay, to your point of, you know, dogma handed down, one of the things that they looked at in this study is the fact that these are third generation oral contraceptives with low dose hormones, and all of our previous studies were on much higher doses of hormones. And because we are not on that podcast of you know, hormone therapy and the, you know, maybe in the OBGYN field, I didn't know that, you know, how much lower those doses were and particularly how much lower those risks may be of a vascular event. And so, you know, yes, the central health dogma was based off of old information and how we can update ourselves, you know, with a great paper like this that now is looking at our current risk factors.
Absolutely. Well, this is great food for thought. And like Yoshi was saying, and Priya, you referenced this kind of begs the question of, you know, this just adds another great study to the conversation. Priya, any last thoughts before we move on to the final paper?
Yeah, I will say one thing. I think what this paper does for me, especially as a female who's, you know, of this age group, is, you know, it can be pretty impactful to take a patient off of an oral contraceptive or take them off of a female hormone therapy. And so I think that instead of stopping therapy, it's more important to maybe decrease dosages. And it makes me feel more comfortable in doing that, because stopping a young girl from having an OCP can really change the trajectory of her life. And so something important to think about is every action we do has a consequence. And so in the absence of a strong recommendation, if I had a young girl who had a vein occlusion, I might say, hey, you know what, let's get you on a low dose estrogen, or maybe let's even consider just a progesterone only analog and kind of work with the OB or work with the primary a little bit more than trying to just say, let's just stop therapy altogether.
Right. And this kind of ties back to our racial and socioeconomic paper. Remember, a lot of the dogma Nick was talking about was written, unfortunately, or fortunately, for better or for worse, by a primarily male physician population, male ophthalmologist population years ago. And that doesn't mean that the dogma is wrong, but that does also bring to question, if we find the dogma is not evidence, again, that impact has to be kind of understood. And it's useful to have someone bringing that, and more people bringing that perspective to this conversation. So let's move on to the last paper, and I'll run through this quickly. This is also from JAMA Ophthalmology. This is a paper called Efficacy and Safety of a Proposed Ranibizumab Biosimilar Product versus a Reference Ranibizumab Product for Patients with Neovascular Age-Related Macular Degeneration, a randomized clinical trial. And this is by Wu with Bressler as the senior author. This was published online November 19, 2020. And what they're talking about is a ranibizumab biosimilar. So it's really important to distinguish biosimilars from generics. And they do this in the first paragraph of the paper. And one of the things they talk about is that biosimilars are different, right? They have similar or equivalent active ingredients. And that is different than generics, where it's basically the brand name drug, but the same active ingredient, right? So they still offer the opportunity for less costly therapy. And this is not just an issue within the United States. This is an international issue, getting patients more low-cost anti-VEGF options for a big, big cause of blindness. Yoshi, I think today or yesterday you posted on Twitter a paper about the causes of blindness worldwide. Well, macular degeneration is one of those. Diabetic retinopathy, which is also a VEGF responsive often condition, is also one of those. So this is really critical. So this is, again, a study result looking at a randomized double-masked parallel group study. It's a phase 3 study across 9 countries, and it was conducted over about a year and a half, and they had 700-plus patients enrolled. And if you look at the two groups, they separated patients to getting the biosimilar versus ranibizumab into fairly equal groups. The big take-home points was that there was essentially equivalent efficacy, similar safety, similar immunogenicity. And this supports that this biosimilar could be used for patients with neovascular age-related macular degeneration. Limitations, obviously, they were looking really early on at the results. The study will continue out to 52 weeks, but this is the 24-week or 6-month kind of result time point. But this is really an interesting thing that we're going to see as we go forward in the future, is this ability to offer therapy to patients at a less costly level, facilitate patients' access to therapy. And so I will bring you guys back into this conversation. Now, Priya, we'll kind of work our way backwards. We can talk a little bit about the study design, but it's not necessarily that different in terms of how they chose to do this. It's a fairly simple kind of randomization process in terms of how they randomized patients compared the groups. You know, typical outcome points like we talked about, you know, ETDRS letters as well as central subfield thickness. But I think it's more interesting to talk about the implications of biosimilars. So, I mean, what do you take when you read a paper like this? This is a phase 3 study. We're not yet at 52 weeks, so approval of these biosimilars may take some time, but it won't be long until we do have biosimilars on the market. What will we do in terms of using this in our day-to-day practice?
Well, I think that I'm looking forward to it to kind of help decrease the barriers to care, especially for our patients who have high deductible health plans or our patients who are not able to get ranibizumab or the other branded drugs. And I think that a lot of the insurance companies, as long as the biosimilars are safe, a lot of the insurance companies will require biosimilar therapy prior to bumping up to a branded drug. And so I do anticipate that we'll see a lot of changes. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I will say I am very skeptical of any new drug right now, ever since Beovu had that report of intraocular inflammation. So I don't want to start getting too far ahead of ourselves until we make sure that there are no reports of intraocular inflammation in these patients. I think that's key, is safety. And once we've proven safety and things are safe, I do anticipate wide adoption of biosimilars.
Yoshi, what's your perspective? Let's say this, Priya just brought up the point about maybe as a physician community, we're just a little more leery, all of us as retinal physicians, about newer drugs. I think many of us were conservative and cautious from the beginning. This probably made us more cautious. If and when this biosimilar is available on the market, how, and again, insurance companies may dictate some of this. There's the real world cost issue where they may just say, hey, you have to use a biosimilar instead of ranibizumab. And I think as physicians, we always fight for our choice to do what we think is best for our patients. But how are we going to navigate that? And also, again, from an adoption standpoint, all things being equal, where will you kind of start to use this?
Right. So I agree with Priya that safety is our, you know, first priority for sure. And regarding the market forces, let's talk about that for a second. I think when we consider as biosimilars of biologics in other fields like oncology and rheumatology, this has happened already, whether it's Remicade or Rituxan, even Avastin have biosimilars now, and they're gradually increasing in market share the past couple of years. And what I realized was that they come at a discount, but they're still not super cheap either. They're not like generic medications. It's not going to be like providing Avastin. In general, they tend to be like 20 to 40% cheaper. We have no idea what it's going to be like for this ranibizumab biosimilar when or if it gets approved, but it's not going to be a generic alternative. And biosimilars are often still being branded and marketed as branded medications. And when the ranibizumab biosimilar comes out, it's not going to be cheap like bevacizumab. And looking at the biosimilars in other fields and how we adopt it, I think will really depend on the pricing, the reimbursement, patient assistance programs, whether they're going to have it or not, what the payers will want to do, like Jay, you mentioned, and what the rest of the field looks like. Because we have many other interesting options also coming up soon in terms of longer-acting medications, most likely on implantable devices and hopefully gene therapies also. And I think that'll also influence how we incorporate biosimilars into our practices. And right now, also what I think is interesting is that throughout the country, more people, I believe, use aflibercept. And although Avastin, I believe, nationwide is being used the most. And interestingly, Samsung, who is running this biosimilar, also has the Eylea biosimilar currently in phase 3 trials as well. And so there will be some self-cannibalization to some extent, but more so that'll eat into Eylea space, of course. And so I think the future for Retina, the next couple of years, it's going to be very interesting and exciting. And I think that ultimately having more options is always better so that we can treat patients very individually for what we think is best for their vision.
Great, great points, Yoshi. Couldn't have said it better myself. And I actually couldn't say it better myself, so I'm glad you said it. Nick, kind of hard, tough act to follow, but what are your thoughts about this and perspectives on what we'll see as we move forward?
Well, those are all fantastic points, and I think the point Yoshi just brought up about new companies within the same space will hopefully provide competition. And I think with competition, you're looking for the best outcomes, the safest outcomes, and it's going to provide hopefully the best for the patients then. This is not generic, as he said, and so it's not going to be priced as such, but it could fall in between if you do want a prefilled syringe, if you do want to not have a compounded drug, but can't quite get to the higher prices. Maybe this does fall in between. I did think the study was interesting for measuring the best corrected visual acuity at 8 weeks also. They basically wanted to assess the efficacy right as the fluid resolved and the pharmacodynamic activity was the highest. And they actually measured the CST for some international regulatory bodies only at 4 weeks. So the efficacy of this was basically, what is the initial hit and does that compare? And it does compare. So we still don't really have knowledge about the efficacy long term. And I know you spoke about that, but I just thought the 8 week and the 4 week periods were in quite contrast to a lot of other studies that we see. And their safety data did extend to the 24 week period, and they will be carrying that forward.
And there's all sorts of trickle down effects that we can touch on as well, right? I mean, does that extra competition, there's good parts of the competition, but it makes you curious. You know, these companies, you talked about high deductible plans, but Genentech, Regeneron, again, I've done some consulting for Regeneron, so I'll just state that here, though it's listed in disclosures. But Genentech and Regeneron and these other companies have competed with each other to provide patient assistance programs, right, where they'll pay for copays or they'll pay for drug for patients who meet certain income thresholds, or they can get patients into foundations where they get covered for their medication. They, provide rebates to practices that offer some of a profit margin for practices they may not get with bevacizumab. How will that be affected? We don't know. I mean, no one knows what would happen, but it would be interesting if Yoshi is talking about market share. As market share gets cut into, do we see a change in those dynamics and those trickle down to retina practices and their patients? I don't know if you have any thoughts on top of what I've said or what Nick or Yoshi have said, Priya.
I agree with what everyone said. I think these are all fantastic points. It'll be very, very interesting. I think Yoshi brought up an amazing point, which is not something that I think thought about, which is how are biosimilars going to really interact with the fact that we're using the port delivery system or gene therapy or other routes of suprachoroidal therapy, et cetera. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see how this kind of interacts. But I agree with him that the more products that we have on the market, the more competition we have, the better it'll overall be for our patients.
Great way to end it. Guys, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on this podcast at a busy time for all of you in your practices. And I appreciate you joining for this Journal Club. Thank you all.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jay.
Have a good night, everyone.
Night.
Many thanks to our contributors for this episode. As always, you can find all 272 episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. They are sorted by category and searchable. We are also on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can get updates on episodes through many fashions. You can subscribe via the mailing list function on our website. You can subscribe via the Apple Podcast or Android Podcast app on your mobile device. That's what I like to use to keep track of the latest episodes. And you can also check our social media accounts. You can reach us in various manners, either by reaching out via social media or by emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. The contact us link on our website will also take you to a submission page where you can submit feedback to our email. We love the feedback we get as we near the end of this year. Please let us know what you'd like to see going forward in the future. Again, thanks to Drs. Farber, Vicaria, and Yonakawa for their help with this episode. Thank you, as always, to Drs. Angela Chang, Louis Kai, and Mike Vinicasso, who handle all of the production social media associated with this podcast episode and all the other podcast episodes over the last 4+ years. Many thanks to you, listeners, for the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.